Last week, I participated in a disaster training exercise in Wisconsin, and during the training, a real-world disaster occurred for one of the members in our unit. A doctor in our unit found out that his family was in an automobile accident, and two of his very young children were killed, and his third child was terribly injured. And all of us were shaken by the tragedy. It was just an unthinkable thing. One of my chaplains traveled back on a military transport that night to deliver him to his family. And the next night, we gathered in an auditorium on base, and even though the doctor wasn't there, we held a memorial service for the children, but we mostly held it for us. And so we sang Amazing Grace, we read Psalm 23, we prayed, we asked God to help the family, and we asked God to help us. So the question, and it may seem like an obvious question, but the question is, why in the world did we do that? I mean, why did we ask God to help that family now? Why didn't God help them before the semi-truck crashed into that van with kids in a car seat? Why would we talk to a God who would allow this to happen when it's in his ability to stop it? Why didn't we gather in the auditorium and collectively shake our fists at heaven and demand God explain himself? Wouldn't a trial make more sense than a worship service? Sometimes we sing, I don't understand your ways, but I will give you all of my praise. Why? Why do we do that? Shouldn't we demand that God make himself and his ways understandable to us if he wants our praise? Now, if you know me, you know I don't believe any of that at all. But I do believe we should talk honestly about that here. This is the place to talk about that. Because we don't need to wrestle with these difficult things by ourselves outside of our family worship environment. I had a seminary class years ago where the professor had us read a book written by an atheist, and the next week some of my classmates were distraught. You've heard this story before, some of you. They said, we shouldn't be reading this, it's troubling. And my professor said correctly, this is the place to read this, where we can work through it together. And then our professor, my professor, would dismantle this atheist arguments in class. I later found out that my professor did the same thing with this atheist in a public televised debate. So the questions are there, and hiding from them does not make them go away. They might just pop up at the worst possible time. This is our third week in Romans 9. And if you were thinking about, if you know Romans 9 and 10, 11, if you're looking forward to it, thinking, I'm finally going to get some easy, satisfying answers to these huge questions of God's sovereignty and human responsibility, you're probably disappointed. I don't know how it works. I know it works. Completely convinced it works. But there are a lot of things I don't know how they work that I use every day. I don't know how my computer works, combustion engines work, jet engines work, photons work, but I know they work. In terms of God's sovereignty and human responsibility in my own life, there have been a couple of times where I was pretty sure God has spoken to me about a certain direction and an outcome, a future outcome, that he had said, this is going to happen. And I didn't just say, well, if he said it's going to happen, then I can think about and do something else. What it did was it made me feel more responsible to work and pray. And in both cases, it ended up being decades doing what was next, asking God to help me, sometimes wondering if it would happen. And the things that I thought God had said would happen did happen. So the question is, did they happen because God decided before the fact they would, or because I worked? Where's the wrong word in that sentence? The or. There's no or. God had decided and I worked. It's not or, it's and. Look at Acts 27. Paul was being transported by ship to Rome for trial. The ship encountered a terrible storm. I'll read verse 20. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. After the men had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourself this damage and loss. But now, keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve, stood before me and said, don't be afraid. You will stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So he said, this is going to happen. God spoke to me. So they should have just relaxed, enjoyed the bumpy ride. It's just going to happen. But a few verses later, verse 30, the sailors didn't really believe Paul. In an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down to the sea, pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. And Paul said to the centurion, the guy, the military soldier in charge, unless these men stay with the ship, you can't be saved. Okay, now Paul, this is confusing. No one's going to be lost. God has said it will happen. Now you're saying, unless these men stay with the ship, you can't be saved. Which is it? It's and. God has said it, and unless these men stay with the ship, you can't be saved. Paul was not confused on the ship, and he's not confused when he wrote Romans. It is and, not or. God is sovereign, and you and I are responsible. It doesn't work on paper. It's 2 plus 2 equals 5. But fortunately, we don't live on paper. We live in a real world. We live in a world where it's reasonable and appropriate to sing, I don't understand your ways, but I will give you all of my praise. We live in a world where it was entirely appropriate to gather together when a member of our unit lost his children and worship God and ask God to help them. So today we're going to look at three big questions from Romans 9. The first one will go back to some verses that we already covered. And then the second two will move forward towards the end of this chapter. So the first question is, can God be trusted? Which is really what all of Romans 9, 10 is about, and 11. Second, is God just? And then the third is, what right does God have to judge us? So is God a liar? Can he be trusted? No, God's not a liar. God kept his promises. His promises were addressed not to all of Abraham's descendants, but to the Israel that believes. And we've seen this already in Romans. But in Romans 9, 6, he said, it's not as though God's word had failed, for not all who are descended from Israel are Israel. So there have always been two Israels, so to speak, and one by birth, just you're born into the Jewish family, and one by faith. God called a people from among all peoples of the world. From this people group came the Messiah, and out of this people group, some believed, some didn't. So, no, the fact that the church did not have a lot of Jewish people, did not mean that God's promises had failed. Well, then is God unjust in the way that he's behaved? And Paul said no. To Moses, he stressed his mercy, to Pharaoh, his power and judgment, using them as an example. It's not unjust to show mercy to the undeserving. It's also not unjust to harden those who've hardened themselves. So in Romans 9, 14 and following, he says, what shall we say then? Is God unjust? Not at all. To Moses, he said, I'll have mercy on whom I'll have mercy and have compassion on whom I have compassion. It does not therefore depend on man's desire or effort, but on God's mercy. For Scripture said to Pharaoh, I raise you up for this very purpose, that I might display my power in you, and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. Therefore, God has mercy on whom he wants to have mercy, and he hardens whom he wants to harden. And the way Paul defends God's justice is by proclaiming his mercy. There are different options about what's going on in this passage. John Stott and others believe that God has never said to harden anyone who has first not hardened himself. Regarding Pharaoh, if you look in Exodus, it said at one time that Pharaoh hardened himself. Another time it says God hardened him. Another time it says that he was hardened and the cause is unspecified. And so the writer of Exodus is not confused. It's just all true in different ways. And the mystery is not that some people remain hard. The mystery is that some are made soft. Some people are saved, others are not. But the mystery, the wonder, is that any are saved at all. But that still doesn't resolve something inside of us. And that thing inside of us is, why aren't all saved? And so an antinomy is when there are two beliefs or two conclusions that by themselves are reasonable and by themselves are true. But when you put together, they seem like they're in a contradiction. And so here, if anyone is lost, the blame is theirs because all have sinned. If anyone is saved, the credit is God's. It makes sense. You put them together, you go, well, why? Why doesn't he save everybody? So question one, is God a liar? We get a straightforward answer. Here's the historical biblical evidence. God's not a liar. The promises he made were to the people of faith. Is God just? Question number two, we get a more challenging answer, and that is, he has mercy on who he wants to have mercy on. That seems harsh, but if he had not showed mercy to some, none would be saved. And then the third question is, if it all depends on God and not on us, then why does he blame us? And to this question, we get a question. We don't get an answer. Why does God blame us? Who are you, oh man, to talk back to God? That can feel like a slap. It's like you're asking an honest why, and you're told, shut up, it's because I told you so. But is this really an honest why? This is a hypothetical questioner Paul's addressing here. Is this really the heart of a childlike why, or is this the question of a human who thinks he's close to being a peer of God's? I have a new friend from last week who told me that he was telling me his story at dinner, and he told me how he had planned his life out, and he was going to allow God to be his kind of junior partner on his plans, and then God, in some really hard and really wonderful ways, showed him that God is not his partner. He is the Lord of his life. He has complete rights of ownership. And so this is not a harsh shut up, how dare you question me. This is a larger question designed to lead to a larger perspective. He is God. We are created things. So it would be like a child, but not like a child asking an honest why, but a child demanding that a parent explain herself, or the child will not comply. And it so happens that there's no way in the world a child will ever understand the issue, but it's very important the child comply. And Job was that child. Job suffered, had no idea why he was suffering. He had some friends who brought him some pat answers, some pat Christian answers. That, you know, it's obvious that you're suffering because you've just done some bad things. If you do more good things, then better things would happen to you, which is nonsense, but it was believed then and still believed now. I heard it last week. And in the end, Job had to actually intercede to God for his friends who were giving him all this godly advice, because God said, I'm going to smack them because they're speaking wrong of me. Job had a lot of legitimate questions, we all do, and no good parent's going to tell a child with a real question, shut up, quit asking questions. But what happened was, as you go through the book of Job, his questioning devolved into accusation. He looked at his circumstances, concluded that God could not be trusted, and so he decided that he could take God to trial. And so when he decided to take God to trial, his questions turned into accusations. Then God answered his questions with questions. Like, who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man, and I'll answer you. I'll question you, and you're going to answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? So when Job accused God, he got a question, not an answer. Who are you to question me? Does that bother you? I think it bothers a lot of people. But I think it bothers us when we lose sight of really who we're talking about here. We're talking about God, eternal, all-powerful, all-knowing, all times and all places ever before him. We're not talking about a little bit greater than us. We're talking about the one who spoke everything into existence. And so it's super important to get some context for our questions, and that's what I think Paul is doing here. And so he takes this hypothetical questioner, and he says, one of you might say to me, then why does God still blame us? For who resists his will? So if God is in charge, if he makes a decision, then why should I be blamed for anything? And he doesn't try to give a logical reason response to this. Instead, he gives a logical reason question to answer the question. Who are you, O man, to talk back to God? Shall what is formed say to him who formed it, why did you make me like this? Does not the potter have the same right to make out of the same lump of clay? Some pottery for noble purposes, some for common use. And this is just an analogy. And compared to God, we are like lumps of clay. But it's not a perfect analogy, because we know this clay potter is not the whole story, because no potter would give his life for a lump of clay. But the potter did give his life for us. But the rebel who shakes his fist and demands why, and there's no question mark after the why, there's an exclamation mark. Demands why, the answer he gets to his question is a question. Watch yourself. You know you're in waters over your head. Who are you to talk back to God? Good parents will teach their children, there's no question you can't ask me, But there is an attitude in which you must not address me. It's not because a parent's insecure or arrogant, but it's because a parent is wise. Honest questions lead children to wisdom. Arrogant attitudes lead children into deeper folly. So Paul asks two more questions that are more like, think about it like this. So he says, what if God, choosing to show his wrath and make his power known, bore with great patience the objects of his wrath, prepared for destruction? And then what if he did this to make the riches of his glory known to the objects of his mercy, whom he prepared in advance for glory? So some believe verse 22 means that God prepares some for destruction and some for heaven. So he chooses, you're going to hell and you're going to heaven. Some believe that it means they prepared themselves for destruction and God was patient with them, waiting on them to change. In the verse, it doesn't say who did the preparing. It just says, prepare for destruction. So it does say that he prepared some for glory and others were prepared for destruction. So there are a couple of lines of thinking about this passage. Let me give you the main lines of thinking. The first line of thinking, and these are from people who take the scriptures and God seriously. God selects those who go to heaven and God selects those who go to hell without regard for their personal choice. Second, God selects those who go to heaven and allows others to remain in their hardness, so they sort of self-select hell. Three, others believe God responds to human choice and then makes his choice. And then finally, not really finally, there are lots of variations, but it's going to be finally for us. Finally, there are those who believe, this is a little bit more abstract, but that God is not tied to time like we are. God is not limited to time and space. He is timeless and he is larger than the physical universe. So there's a sense in which all time is an eternal now for him. And so these people believe that God's choice and our choice happen simultaneously. It's not just foreknowledge where God knows in advance what we're going to do, but God is responding from his place of timelessness. He's seeing all time as a single piece of paper to our choice. That's a little bit mind-blowing, but we are talking about God here. You're welcome to land wherever you want. It's okay to come to a settled conclusion. Some of you have settled conclusions, some of you don't. It's okay if you don't. But let me tell you what I believe. To be fully biblical in regards to God's sovereign human responsibility, you must embrace both his sovereignty and your choice. You must embrace them both fully. I've read all the positions. I've read book after book after book. They all make some sense. They all still end up with some mystery, which is to be expected. I don't know how it works. I know it works. So think about a clock, not a digital clock, but a clock that had cogs, old wheels. And in a clock with wheels, there's a wheel turning this way and a wheel turning in the opposite direction. And so think about God's sovereignty, human responsibility. Wheels turning in opposite directions, but they're working together to make this timepiece work. So let me offer some practical considerations. First, you don't have to have it all figured out to believe well or live well in light of the gospel. No human is exactly sure how photons or light works. But we live well in spite of that lack of knowledge. We need light. We need photons. So full knowledge is not required to live well. Second, you do have to decide what's going to be the standard for what you believe. I mean the base standard for what you believe. And I've said it before, but I'll remind you that there really are, at the bottom, only two choices. You can believe that the standard for belief is the human mind, or you can believe the standard for belief is what God's revealed himself to us. And the human mind would include science, observation, experimentation. Science can't tell us ultimate things. I've said it before. So you have to decide what's going to be the foundation, the ground floor for what you believe. If the scriptures say God is completely sovereign and you're completely responsible for your choices, then you can agree or disagree with that. That's your two choices. You can disagree, maybe because you don't understand it, and so you're going to disagree with some part of that. If you disagree, then the foundation for what you believe is you. You trust you. And that's an option. You can decide to trust you. If you believe that we need God to reveal to us what we can't discover for ourselves, and he's done this in scriptures, and so you decide to believe that God is completely sovereign and humans are completely responsible, even though you don't know how it all works, that's not blind faith. Any more than blind faith to believe those photons are actually bringing light to this room. It's not blind faith. You don't have to have full understanding to have reasonable faith. Because in the end, everybody decides who or what they're going to believe. Third observation is, if God is not who you want him to be, or he doesn't act like you think he should act, then I think that says more about us than about him. So to contemplate as a person judging God, do you see what that says about us? When my oldest daughter, Crystal, was about 5, I think, she had gone to battle with her mom all day, wore her mom out. She was in her room, and she told me that she remembers sitting on her bed thinking, when Dad gets home, he's going to agree with me. And she's looking out the window, waiting anxiously for me to get home. And she said, it wasn't until I pulled in the driveway that the thought suddenly occurred to her, I'm in big trouble. He's not going to agree with me. No way. And I didn't agree with her, by the way. And she was in big trouble. And there are those, I think, who really believe that if and when they have their shot at God, when they have their chance to address him face to face, which is what, if you read Job, he said this. They're going to set him straight. They're going to show him his mistakes. They're going to show him how he should have acted. And somehow he's going to go, you know, that thought never occurred to me. That's amazing insight. I just never would have thought of that. That's just not going to be how it goes. When we see him face to face, we're just not going to have any questions. We're going to barely survive the encounter. Which brings us to 4. We don't have to yield to reality in our hearts. We don't have to. But we will yield to reality in our lives. So you can refuse to respect the reality of fire in your heart, in your mind, but it'll still burn your hand. You can try to pet a grizzly bear because you refuse to believe something that brown and fuzzy could kill you, and it will still eat you. And so people are free to not yield to God in their hearts. They don't have to believe he is who he says he is, but they will not be free to live outside the consequences of the reality of God as he is. And that's really what Paul's saying. He's reasoned, and he said, bottom line is, you're not going to get your mind around this. And if you get to the point where you can't get your mind around it, and your final response is to shake your fist at God, then now you've gone from questioning to pure rebel. And the only appropriate response to that is, who do you think you are? And in 5, this is our last conclusion, observation, is even though it's difficult to get our minds around this issue, it's really not difficult to figure out what we should do with it. What do you do with God is sovereign, I'm responsible? You trust and you obey. For there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. We believe, so we live with faith, and then when good things happen, with gratitude, not pride. We choose to obey God. Long obedience in the same direction. Yesterday I spoke and prayed at a retirement for a lady who served 24 years in the military. Some of you know her, Joanna Hupp. She's done amazing things over her career, and some of the most amazing things is that in the middle of a busy career, a pilot flying all over, her husband was in a horrible car crash the first year of their marriage, barely survived, and she's been able to finish her career. And so I ask at the retirement, is Joanna here finishing her career because she was faithful or because God was faithful? Same rhetorical question. And I said, of course, the problem is the or. She's here because Joanna was faithful and God was faithful. And when we live this way, believing God is in control and believing our choices matter, life works because this is how the world really is. So, should we gather to request the grace and help of God for a family who just lost 2 small children in a terrible crash? Yes, we should. And we did. Let's go back 4 chapters and see where God's given us a demonstration of a reason to trust him. Now, pay attention. He's giving a demonstration, not a mere explanation. Romans 5:8, God demonstrates his love for us in this: while we were sinners, Christ died for us. Men and women through the ages have suffered and still trusted God. They suffered and trusted God and experienced and glorified God through their suffering. And even when they have not gotten answers, they have experienced God's presence. So Psalm 23, we read at the memorial, it does not promise there will be no walks through the valley of shadow of death. It also doesn't promise that there will be answers as to why you're in the valley of shadow of death. But what is it promise? Those who know the verse, what's it promise? His presence in the valley. His rod and his staff, protection and direction will be there. In John 6, Jesus gave some strong teaching to the larger group of people following him. We sometimes think it was just 12, but there were the crowds ebbed and flowed. There were many, many people, men and women, large groups followed him. And at one point, there was a pretty large group, and Jesus was teaching them some stuff. It's you can read it in John 6, and they didn't like what they were hearing. Some of it, they didn't make sense to them. Some of it, they just flat bothered them. And so in John 6, verse 66, it says, from this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. So they said, I'm out. Forget it. I didn't sign on for this. And so he looked at the 12 after a bunch of them peeled away, and he said, how about you? You guys out too? And he wasn't taking an opinion poll like a politician trying to find out, should I refine my message because I'm losing some followers here? It was a real question. What you're hearing from me, he said, is what is real. Do you want to stay with me or not? So this is real. Do you want out? And Simon Peter answered, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. Peter was going to struggle later on, and he would eventually get it right. He would become Peter the Rock, but his confession here is right. And this is the final thing I'll say to you. You know, there's only one God, and he is who he's revealed himself to be. And my conclusion is, where else can I go? This is the truth. This is real. Let's pray together. I'd like you to prepare your heart for worship. And when you worship, you bring your emotions, but you worship with all your mind. And so bring your questions, your struggles. Become as a man or a woman before God. Come to worship, not as a peer or even a junior partner. And we're going to finish with worship. That's going to be our application, our main application this morning. So get your heart ready, if you would, please.